Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Gillian Shepherd, Director of the Trendle Center at La Trobe University. This is episode CXCIV, Sea Monsters in Roman Mythology. Rome has always been a seafaring power, relying on the ocean for food and trade. But what lies beneath the waves can chill the hearts of mortal men, and tales of aquatic horror were commonplace in antiquity. Here's Gillian Shepherd. So, Gillian, how important was the sea in antiquity?
Well, it was absolutely crucially important. It was a resource in terms of food. Fish were a significant part of the diet. And often quite a delicacy as well. But it also provided access to other resources, particularly in the Roman Empire, when you've got this vast empire surrounding the Mediterranean, or Mare Nostrum, our sea, as the Romans called it. And freight and trade that was seaborne was far and away the fastest and easiest way to move stuff around the ancient world. But at the same time, it was hazardous. You've got obviously bad weather, you've got shipwrecks, you've got ships that could be overloaded, you have at certain periods piracy is a real problem, and of course you've got the sea monsters.
So as a result of this importance, sea monsters are going to be an important part of the mythology because there's so much interaction with the waters around the Mediterranean, aren't they?
Yes, they are. And you've got the actual mythology, but that's not necessarily without basis, perhaps, because there are big animals that live in the Mediterranean, which the Romans and the ancient Greeks and all the other ancient peoples around the Mediterranean would not have seen very often. So ancient seafaring is mainly coast hugging, because that's safer generally. And that's also how you navigate. You use the stars to some degree, but you use the coastline as well. So venturing out into the open sea, although it did happen, it wouldn't have been that common. So the ancients were not that familiar with these enormous animals, whales and so forth, that live in the Mediterranean, but would be rarely seen and not seen alive very often.
Yeah, okay, okay. So if you had a whale or something that washed up on a beach, an attempt to explain it would be, well, this is a monster from the deep. And I guess in some ways it is, if you want to interpret a whale as being a monster.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And I mean, the Romans knew about whales. You know, they have the word for a whale, a balaena. But these big whales that live in the Mediterranean, particularly the fin whale and the minke whale, they don't surface very often. And as you say, when they died, by the time they washed up on shore, they could be in an unrecognizable state. If still relatively intact, they'd be very bloated because the gases in the stomach swell them. You could get a carcass that was heavily decomposed, unrecognizable, and had fragmented as well. So you might get bits of semi-articulated bones washing up. And I've seen that myself on a beach, what was obviously the flipper of a whale.
Yeah.
And it's colossal, and because it's detached, and if you're not familiar with the animal, well, yeah, that's how you'd explain it, as some sea monster.
So what was a sea monster then to a Roman? These are myths that I guess it's easy to say that Rome takes everything from the Greeks when it comes to mythology.
quite a lot.
And I know that some of that's going to come up here, but to a Roman, what was a sea monster?
Well, the word actually is the same in Latin and Greek,
of
acatus.
Course, yes.
Right. Yeah. That's got a pretty broad meaning. It can mean any big fish, it can mean a whale, it can mean a sea monster. And the forms these monsters could take vary quite a lot. Now, some of our literary descriptions of them, they do sound rather like whales. They're described as having barnacles on their backs, for example. In our imagery that we have, they can take all sorts of forms. Some of them are more snaky or serpent-like. Often you see a so-called kytos with an almost dog-like snout, but then a long snaky tail as well. So a lot of it, I suppose, was left to the imagination as to how the artist might want to depict these things.
Yeah, yeah. I will get back to artist depiction. Was there a strong association with the gods?
Fairly strong. It depends exactly what type of sea monster, if you like, or some other mythical sea being you're talking about.
Mm.
So, for example, amongst the more benign ones, shall we say, are the Tritons. Now, Triton was originally the son of the king of the sea, Neptune, and Amphitrite. But then we hear about multiple Tritons, and they're sort of mermen types, I suppose, and not necessarily terribly scary. And there are other inhabitants of the sea that are more anthropomorphic, the Nereids, for example, the sea nymphs. So they're all connected. They all belong to this divine world of the sea in that sense. It's the monsters, I suppose, that are the scariest and are very often linked, I guess, with the gods using the monsters sometimes for revenge. Now, one of the oldest stories is the story of Hesione and the sea monster. Now, she was the daughter of King Laomedon of Troy. And the gods Poseidon and Apollo helped King Laomedon out by building him the famous walls of Troy.
Mm.
But King Laomedon didn't pay for the work, so they got a bit annoyed, understandably. And Poseidon, as god of the sea, sends Aketos, a monster, to attack Troy. And the only way to stop it is for the king to chain up his daughter to a rock and sacrifice her to this monster.
Mm.
Now, fortunately, the hero Heracles steps in and rescues her and kills the monster and everything else. Laomedon then doesn't really repay Heracles either. I mean, he just doesn't learn at all from his mistakes. So Heracles then comes back a bit later and sacks Troy. But that's a different story. But the point is the sea gods could use these monsters as their tools of revenge, if you like.
Mm. And I guess that these mythological stories are really told through depictions. You mentioned that artists depicted these scenes, and I guess you'd get them on walls of villas and those kind of things where you would decide that you want something nice to look at. You would get a nice mythological scene from a text, and therefore you would get a sea monster sometimes.
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, some of our very earliest images are on ancient Greek vase paintings, and they predate the texts, which is not to mean there wasn't some story floating around, but it wasn't necessarily written down. But then particularly, apart from the Greek vase paintings, when you get to the Roman period, yes, you do see these stories on wall paintings. And in fact, the story of Perseus and Andromeda, which is related to this Hesione myth in many ways, it's again, you know, a daughter has to be sacrificed to a sea monster to keep everybody
happy.
Yeah,
noticing a theme, sure.
I mean, in this case, it was the story of the king of Ethiopia, Cepheus, whose wife Cassiope boasted that she was more beautiful than the Nereids. Now, claiming you're more beautiful or better or something or other than some divine being is always a big mistake in antiquity, always ends badly. So again, we have the punishment of the daughter. Andromeda is chained to a rock. The sea monster is threatening her. Fortunately, the hero Perseus zips in on the way back from killing the Gorgon, manages to rescue Andromeda, kills the sea monster, and it all ends happily ever after. But it's very much a parallel myth. And in Roman mythological wall paintings, so we're talking here about the paintings in Pompeii and Herculaneum and that area that was destroyed by Vesuvius in 79 CE. Of the mythological scenes, the Perseus and Andromeda scene is one of the most popular.
Really?
Yeah. Daedalus and Icarus is another one, and there are a few others that are very, very popular. And it's interesting, in fact, that most mythological scenes in Roman wall painting are of myths with a Greek origin. Mm. You see very little in the way of straight-out Roman myth in those wall paintings. Perseus Andromeda is one of the most popular ones, and some of the scenes have things in common that suggest there's some prototype, perhaps an original ancient Greek painting that people are having a sort of repro done in their villas. And so we see Perseus Andromeda really quite a lot. It's a popular myth at the time.
How are they depicting the sea monster in particular? Is there a lot of variety in it?
Well, the sea monster isn't always hugely visible. One type of the scene shows Perseus sort of helping Andromeda off the rock, and the focus is very much on them.
Mm.
But thrashing around a bit vaguely in the background, you can kind of see a sea monster just to remind you of the story and make it obvious. But the focus is definitely on the hero and the heroine. But there's actually another very famous one that is now in the Metropolitan Museum in New York. that comes not from Pompeii or Herculaneum, but from a big villa at a place called Bosto Trecase. So this was a big country villa that was also destroyed when Vesuvius erupted. Mm-hmm. And this shows a huge landscape scene in which the figures are actually quite small, and it's a synoptic version of the story. So you've got Andromeda chained up to the rock. Then you've got this thrashing monster below that is, I suppose, quite scary, but I always think it looks quite cute, really. It's kind of got tufts of hair and snouts. It looks quite a cuddly, friendly monster, really. But anyway, huge monster thrashing around the sea. Perseus is flying in, literally flying, and you can see it's all going to end happily ever after, because another little vignette in this scene is Perseus kind of greeting Cepheus, and it's all right. And
oh, so like panels of a comic book almost.
Sort of, yeah. It's sort of a comic strip. Yes. So you get the whole story encapsulated in this one scene.
Mm. And that made it all the way to New York.
Yes, there are some fantastic wall paintings. Yeah. Famously, the cubiculum from Bosco Reale also is in New York, which is a more or less complete set of wall paintings.
All right, yep. New York listeners, go and check that out. Where did you say that was?
In the Metropolitan Museum.
Oh, right, in the bigger one. Yep. Okay. And when you say that earlier depictions of these sort of scenes were on Greek amphoras and the like, did they depict sea monsters mostly the same? Because these would predate the written myths, you said.
Yes, again, they can vary a fair bit. And I guess we're seeing some artist's imagination in here. Maybe ideas about bits of whales or something they've seen washed up on the beach.
Mm.
For example, there's quite a famous vase in Italy which shows Heracles attacking the monster that attacked Hesione, presumably. And it's like a huge serpent. It's like a massive snake head with gaping jaws. Elsewhere, a rather famous one on Hydria that shows Heracles again attacking this Ketos, this sea monster, but it's got this more dog-like snout and it's got this long snaky tail with a sort of red crest on it.
Mm.
And as has been pointed out, it's strikingly similar actually to a huge fish that exists in the Mediterranean and elsewhere, but is very rarely seen even today, and that is an oarfish, which can grow up into meters and meters in length.
O-A-R, or?
O-A-R, yeah, or fish, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Meters in length and has got this red crest. I mean, it's really quite striking.
Oh, nice.
So
yeah.
You wonder if that's perhaps where it's coming from.
Bit of influence there.
Yeah.
So how did the Romans tell these stories to each other? What sort of myths were they talking? I mean, I know they were fans of the Greek literature as well, so they've got those stories to rely on, but sea monsters must have been a presence in Roman literature as well.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, they've still got the Greek ones alive and kicking. So, for example, we know that both Sophocles and Euripides, the 5th century Greek playwrights, wrote plays called Andromeda.
Mm.
And, of course, the Romans are still putting on these plays, so they're still very present.
All right, sorry, sidebar. How would they depict the sea monster on stage?
Ah, now that's an interesting question. Yes, with the props. Well, we don't, I think, entirely no.
But we can guess it'd be a bit of panto?
Maybe a bit, yes. There is, again, it's an ancient Greek vase, but it might give us an idea because the stage production techniques wouldn't have changed hugely.
Yeah.
We're not certain it's depicting a play, but you've got almost the panto sea, so the cutout waves of the set.
Yeah.
And rising up behind it is this head of a sea monster that could well be some kind of wooden frame with a skin stretched over it and then painted or something like
that. So it's like a puppet, or maybe even, you know, like how you get Chinese dragons in parades.
Right.
Some sort of costume thing going on.
Something like that perhaps going on.
Cool.
Yeah, to make it really scary.
Off you go. Talk about Roman stuff now.
So it rose up. But then, of course, you've got Roman authors themselves who are very much putting forward their own versions of these myths. So famously, Ovid describes this event where the monster is attacking Andromeda, and he describes this episode in his poem, The Metamorphoses, and he says, "See how the creature comes, parting the waves with surging breasts like a fast ship with a pointed prow ploughing the water." So that's a very vivid image that your average Roman could understand quite readily. Perseus attacked the creature's back and, as it roared, buried his sword to the end of the curved blade in the right side of its neck. Hurt by the deep wound, now it reared high in the air, now it dived underwater, or turned now like a fierce wild boar when the dogs scare him and the pack is baying around him. So again, it's sort of thrashing around, but a hunting image that, again, would have been quite familiar to an audience. Perseus evades the eager jaws on swift wings and strikes with his curved sword wherever the monster is exposed, now at the back encrusted with barnacles, now at the sides of the body, now where the tail is slenderest, ending fish-like. The beast vomits seawater mixed with purplish blood. Mm. So it's a fairly sort of gory image. And it has been suggested that actually here Ovid is perhaps drawing on whales. You've got those barnacles on the back, for example.
Yeah.
Sort of fish-like feature. And this diving, rearing, thrashing and so on, churning water, one can imagine perhaps, and this vomiting is rather similar to the behaviour of baleen whales, in other words, whales that filter the water through their comb-like structure in their mouths to extract the food.
Mm.
Because they will thrash around on the surface quite often. But then they will eject this water as well.
Yeah.
So this sort of vomiting thing
yeah.
might be where it's coming from. So you get these quite vivid descriptions.
Yeah, but not really a lot to describe how the sea monster looks itself. You get an impression of a lot of action, the thrashing
yes.
about and whatever Perseus is up to. But nothing to say, you know, it was this many meters long or, you know, there's
no attempt
exactly.
It's not too specific,
to,
is it? No, you're right. The description relates to things people would be familiar with, like a hunting scene or whatever.
Yeah, true.
So Ovid doesn't go sort of too far with that one.
Mm. So as well as these stories of mythological monsters that we've got, we do have some analytical attempts to explain what these monsters could be or how they would live or whether they do in fact exist. Is this something more characteristic of the Romans in their accounts of the Mediterranean life? Were the Greeks as well trying to explain how these monsters could be reality outside of myth?
I think they do, yes. You get an interest in natural history from about the 4th century BC onwards.
Mm.
So we're in the Hellenistic period then. And that's when you get a lot of other sort of philosophical, scientific inquiry. You also get the rise of things like travel journalism, a wider range of genres there. And an interest in natural history is certainly one of them.
There's a good example of that. You've got one here from Strabo. So he was a geographer.
Mm-hmm.
So what did he write about an encounter with, it seems to be like a whale skeleton, was it?
Yeah, so what Strabo is describing in this particular section of geography is the trip that Nearchos made down the Indus River and around the Persian Gulf.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Nearchos is one of Alexander the Great's admirals, and he's bringing this huge fleet down the Indus and around the Persian Gulf. And Nearchos wrote an account of this trip, which no longer survives to us today, but seems to have been pretty clearly one of the sources for Strabo's geography.
Mm.
And Strabo says quite specifically that Nearchos, in the course of this journey, he's around the Persian Gulf now at the moment, he says he had seen driven on shore a whale 50 cubits in length. Now that would be...
I don't know what a cubit is.
Enormous. Okay, well, if we're talking about... The measurements are always a bit vague, but if we're talking about a Roman cubit,
yeah,
that's about 120 centimetres.
Okay.
So we're talking about a whale here that is, what, 60 metres long.
Mm, yeah.
Now,
yeah.
Even a blue whale is less than half that
yeah.
at its greatest length. So there is an element of exaggeration here, perhaps. But the idea that Nearchos saw such a creature beached is perfectly feasible.
Mm.
And it is being described here as a whale rather than a sea monster.
Okay.
So there's that interest in the natural history, on the wonders, I suppose, of Persia. You know, the same passage talks about how Nearchos in his voyage found pearls in large quantities and trees that smelt like frankincense. It's the exotic nature of this place that is rich and different and bigger and brighter and more exciting.
Yeah, it's an interest in the foreign, really. Yeah. Book 9 of Pliny's Natural History was specifically on fishes and, I guess, you know, aquatic life and what you'd find around the ocean and what have you. So what did he write that could be seen as efforts to explain what a sea monster is or what it could be.
He talks quite specifically about the largest animals and even attributes them to different seas, the Indian Sea, the Galaxy, and so on.
Mm.
He talks about an orca, for example, which could well be what we call an orca. In other words, a killer whale. Mm. They were in the Mediterranean. So there is this interest in explaining and understanding the ancient world, but perhaps still a gap in joining the dots.
Yeah.
In terms of, well, this pile of decomposing bones actually relates to this particular animal. Again, it's a bit vague. One word he uses, Pistrix, could be a sea monster or a whale or a shark. It's anything really huge. You've got the Balaena, the whale. There's something else called a Physeter. That might be, in Pliny's terms, a sperm whale.
Mm.
They're also around the Mediterranean. Well, they're everywhere, really, sperm whales and the Atlantic. And he describes this possible sperm whale in quite specific terms. He says it's the most bulky inhabitant, raising itself aloft like some vast column. And as it towers above the sails of ships, well, that might be a bit of an exaggeration, belching forth, as it were, a deluge of water.
It's breaching. Yeah.
That's what whales do.
Mm.
And if you can imagine something like that that would have been rarely seen, simply because Roman ships didn't go into those sort of waters necessarily, too far out, that must have been quite extraordinary.
Yeah. What does Pliny tell us then about these kind of efforts to interpret sea monsters?
I think often what's quite interesting about it is how political it becomes.
Mm.
And I think it's probably fair to say that this is very often a feature of these bones, these huge bones throughout antiquity. You get in the big Greek period too. So the ancient Greeks and the Romans, they're obviously genuinely coming across a huge set of bones, whether that's bits of whales washed up or a dinosaur popping out of a quarry. These are fossil deposits as well around the Mediterranean. It must have been quite extraordinary coming across these things. And hardly unsurprising that they would interpret them as a monster. And there have been some quite interesting studies that have mapped the geographical location of myths onto the Mediterranean. And there is some degree of correspondence between where these fossil beds are.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So you can sort of attach them geographically quite well. But we do get some quite famous stories. And one of these goes back to the Perseus and Andromeda myth again, where you've got Marcus Scaurus, who's an aedile in Rome in the first century BCE, apparently gets the set of bones of the very monster that attacked Andromeda. Now, the location of the myth has changed a bit. Some versions have Andromeda as the daughter of the king of Ethiopia, but another place that was identified as the location for this sea monster episode was actually Joppa in Judea, so modern Jaffa. The first century historian Josephus, in fact, claimed you could still see the chains on the rock at Joppa where Andromeda had actually been chained up.
Nice.
Now, there might well have been an old set of chains there, you know, just adds to the whole story.
Oh, you know, I know what places do to increase tourism, sure.
Absolutely. So Scaurus gets these bones and he brings them back to Rome and he displays them alongside, according to Pliny, other wonderful things. One would love to know what they were.
Yeah.
But he's creating this public spectacle.
Oh, he's P.T. Barnuming it.
Yeah. And he's a total showman, Scaurus. I mean, this is the guy who put up the incredibly elaborate temporary theatre, for example, with all the marble columns.
Oh, yes. Yeah, quite a lot of it. Publicly funded, and then he put them in his own villa afterwards.
This is in a period when this sort of perhaps the traditional austerity of Roman behaviour is starting to fall away. And Scaurus is really making a big splash in Rome.
Yeah.
And one of the ways he does this is by getting these Andromeda sea monster bones and putting them on display. And he's clearly using them to make himself the centre of attention.
So what does Pliny say about this event then?
Well, he says that these bones exceeded 40 feet in length and the ribs were higher of those of the Indian elephant, while the backbone was a foot and a half in thickness.
Mm.
Yeah, okay, whale bones, you know, that might fit that sort
sure.
of thing.
Yeah.
But it's actually part of quite a long history of the ancients getting a set of bones and using them. I mean, if you go back to, example, Athens in the 5th century, the Athenian democratic statesman Cimon supposedly finds the bones of Theseus, the great sort of mythical hero of Athens, finds them on the island of Scyros, where Theseus was supposed to have died, and brings them back to Athens, brings these bones home. Now, he probably did get a huge set of bones from somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
So they're very often this political tool that is providing this direct link with mythology or cities' heritage or something that is going to be of benefit to the person who's doing this.
And, of course, you know, the average Roman sees those bones. How would they know any different?
Yes. Yes, it would have been a curiosity completely. Yeah. And the traveller Pausanias, who is traveling around Greece and Italy in the 2nd century CE, he will talk about seeing huge sets of monster bones or sea monsters. These things are on display. They help aggrandize a sanctuary or a city or a display. And Pausanias also famously in Rome saw a triton, an actual triton, which from his description seems to have been an early hoax, the sort we're not quite familiar with nowadays, of mocking up a monster by using various bits of real animals and putting them together.
Okay. The last bit that we've got here is something that Pliny actually saw himself, which was witnessing an orca attack display of some sort at the port of Ostia. So I'll get you to read through this, if that's okay, and tell me about this. But it's interesting at the outset here that this is something that could very much be interpreted as a sea monster display, but Pliny is very analytical about it, I think.
I think he is, yes, but it's still an unusual event. So what Pliny says is, he says, an orca has been seen even in the port of Ostia, where it was attacked by the Emperor Claudius. It was while he was constructing the harbour there that this orca came, attracted by some hides which, having been brought from Gaul, had happened to fall overboard there. By feeding upon these for several days, it had quite glutted itself, having made for itself a channel in the shoaly water. Here, however, the sand was thrown up by the action of the wind to such an extent that the creature found it quite impossible to turn round, and while in the act of pursuing its prey, it was propelled by the waves towards the shore, so that its back came to be perceived above the level of the water, very much resembling in appearance the keel of a vessel turned bottom upwards. Upon this, Caesar ordered a great number of nets to be extended at the mouth of the harbour from shore to shore, while he himself went there with the Praetorian cohorts, and so afforded a spectacle to the Roman people. For boats assailed the monster, while the soldiers on board showered lances upon it. I myself saw one of the boats sunk by the water which the animal, as it respired, showered down upon it.
Wow.
Wow.
So it's beached itself. It's amazing, you know, nowadays we would help the whale
help
out.
Help the poor whale.
But now, ye olde days, Claudius goes, well, this is an opportunity here. This is like an aquatic amphitheatre. Let's put on a show.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. It's turned into this spectacle. And it perhaps was a bit unusual because this isn't a remote beach. This thing is coming into an actual
the port of Ostia. Yeah.
The port of Ostia. And obviously was a greedy orca after these hides or whatever, and then found itself stuck there and beached itself. The Romans are never slow on the uptake. They see a PR opportunity and they will see it. And this orca has provided them with one.
Okay, so to finish this up, do you have a favourite depiction that you haven't taken us through yet that you can finish us off with?
I guess I've got a couple, really. I'd always advise people, particularly when travelling in Roman areas, to look out for the mosaics in bathhouses. They will often have fishy scenes.
Oh, yeah. Very thematic, sure.
Sea monsters, not necessarily very scary ones, but the sort of frolicking mythological creatures of the sea. So there's a fabulous one in the Baths of Neptune at Ostia that shows Neptune in his chariot and there's sort of horses that have got normal horse forelegs, but they're sort of a bit fishy and snaky at the back. And he's surrounded by all sorts of sea animals, some of which are perfectly feasible dolphins, although a bit less feasible when you get a little Cupid figure riding the dolphin. Or you've got a hippocamp, which is snaky sea monster with a horse. And you've got tritons in there and they're all kind of frolicking around having a great time.
Yeah.
But another one just to look out for, because you might miss it, is on the very famous Portland Vase. which is in the British Museum. And it's a Roman glass cameo vase of the first century CE. So it's technically amazing. It's very dark blue glass that is covered in a layer of white glass, and then that white glass is cut away to create the cameo image. It has a very checkered history, this thing, and the interpretation of what the scenes show has been the subject of enormous debate.
Mm.
But there is, at one point in the scene wrapped around the vase, what is presumably some sea goddess, and it could be Amphitrite or perhaps Thetis, the mother of Achilles, of course. She was also a sea nymph. And she's seated on the ground, and in her lap is a very cuddly looking Ketos. He's almost sort of fawning on her like a lap dog. bit snaky, rather sort of dog-like snout, but not really terribly scary.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's maybe just a little tiny one to look out for.
It's very much using the term monster with a lot of liberty, I think.
yes, exactly. Yes. So monster in the sense it perhaps didn't really exist. You might be quite surprised if you encountered one, but maybe not. Yeah. Too scary.
That was Dr. Gillian Shepherd, director of the Trendall Centre at La Trobe University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any friendly neighbourhood podcatching service. Please leave a review. They are always very appreciated. You can like Emperors of Rome on our Facebook page, or you can follow us on Twitter. Gillian is at Lady Trendall, I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. That's it today for Emperors of Rome. That's it today for Emperors of Rome. In the next episode, you have questions about Roman themes, and we will bring you the answers. So until then, I'm Matt Smith, you've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.